Hey, everybody. Welcome to another Poison Pen event here in Poison Pen Bookstore in Scottsdale, Arizona. I am Patrick. I am your science fiction and fantasy and young adult selector, and I'm really lucky to have two great YA novelists, Sarah Ella for The Looking Glass Illusion and Candace Cade for Enhanced. Today we're going to be talking about their books, what it's like to be a young adult writer, et cetera, et cetera. It's really a lot of fun. I've got to say that both books are absolutely fantastic, great for the young adult audience. And Looking Glass Illusion is book two in the Curious Reality series. This ends the series. Candace's Enhanced is the first in a series. So we're going to be juggling back and forth between what it's like to start and what it's like to finish a series. And, you know, just talk about the books in general. For those of you who are watching online, feel free to ask questions as you get the chance. We'll be glad to answer the questions at the end of the program. So feel free to ask. It is your chance to be a part of the program as well. Sarah, Candace, welcome.
Thanks for having us, Pat.
Yeah, thank you.
It always feels so strange because today it's pretty quiet in the store, so we've got the microphone's a little louder than usual, I think. So it's always a little weird. You're hearing your voice in the background. So congratulations, Sarah. So The Looking Glass Illusion is book two, which ends your Curious Reality series. This started off as Alice Through the Looking Glass in dystopian future sort of meets Hunger Games, is the best way that I can try to describe your book. How do you classify the Looking Glass Wars and the and your Curious Reality series?
So with the Looking Glass Illusion, it's definitely got a little bit of a pinch of, I say it's a pinch of sci-fi because I'm not smart enough to write actual sci-fi, but it's more of like fantasy. It's a portal fantasy technically, but kind of got that virtual reality Ready Player One type of thing going on. Yeah. One of my best friends just recently compared it to Ready Player One meets Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire. So I said, I will take that.
And, you know, both books put together are about as long as Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire.
Yes. Definitely can't write a book that long.
Well, and why would you want to? Because you'd put somebody's eye out if they fall asleep.
That's true. And also, I mean, it's already been written that well and that long, so why try to duplicate it?
Yep, absolutely. So you're really well known for your fantasy, and you're really well known for writing really exciting books that happen to be also what I love is very clean. I don't have to worry about giving it to your books to an 11 or 12 year old and say, here you go, this is a great book, and it's a great portal into young adult fiction. Was that your intent with the entire series, and kind of your intent as a writer is to try to maybe bridge as much of that young adult gap as possible? And Candace, the same for you, where you're trying to actually write to young adults rather than 24-year-olds?
Yeah, I think that with YA, it like spans every genre. I mean, I am almost 40 and I read YA. I like to say that I want to write books that both I can hand to my 11-year-old, but also that I can hand to my mom. And that my mom could feel comfortable reading too. And so I think with young adult, the beauty of, you know, children's stories, teens, but children's stories is that there is really no age limit for them.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think I would agree. I think it wasn't even a conscious decision. It was more just my upbringing in China. China's a very conservative culture as well. So a lot of the literature, a lot of the films there, a lot of them are screened. You know, if you have a movie showing in the US and then you watch it in the theater in China, they've taken out a lot of the language, a lot of the different scenes they've taken out. So I think I'm just naturally tend to write more conservatively too, just because of my cultural upbringing.
That's really interesting. So Candace, your book Enhanced is kind of a, not a steampunk, a cyberpunk novel written in China in the future with a really exciting mystery to it. And so a lot of what you're pulling in, you actually pulled in, and I didn't realize this till I was reading your biography today. culturally, you were pulling in from where you grew up, and you grew up in China. So tell me how that happened. How did that occur?
I know. Yeah. So I was actually born in Ohio. And then at the age of 4, my parents' work took them to China. So I grew up mostly in the Sichuan province. I went to Chinese school part-time, and then I was homeschooled part-time. And that was pretty much from 4 until college. And then I came back to the U.S. for college. And then when I wrote Enhanced was actually, I had a relocation assignment back to China for my job. So I was living and working in Beijing at the time when I wrote it. So yeah, a lot of the inspiration is just from my time in Chinese school. I have a different Chinese holiday in each of the 3 books that are being written. And they're just some of my favorite holidays that I love celebrating. And it's kind of a way that I get to go back and celebrate them again because I miss them. It's kind of like, you know, if you move to a different country and they didn't celebrate Christmas, you'd be sad about that. You'd be like, I still want to celebrate that. So in this book, it's Mooncake Festival. In book 2, it's around Chinese New Year. And then book 3, there's a holiday as well. But yeah, definitely a lot of the holidays, a lot of the culture, and even the technology. Like, it was really strange growing up in China and then going back 10 years later as an adult, because the technology had changed so much. When I grew up there, you know, we were just starting to see the internet. People were just starting to get dumb phones. And then when I came back, everyone had a cell phone. No one even used cash. Like, everyone paid for stuff with their phones, you know, like smart wallets. And so that's really what got me thinking about Enhanced, was just, if China has changed this much in 10 years, how much is it going to change in 100 years? What would it look like? And so I was working in tech at the time as well. And so I think a lot of that technology also got me thinking about, wow, what would China look like in 100 years? So yeah, a lot of the culture, a lot of the tech definitely influenced Enhanced.
I feel like when I'm reading both of your books, you have almost a color palette to your books themselves. Candace, yours are very neon. Sarah, I feel like yours are very reminiscent of your cover, where they're deep blues, grays, you know, kind of that, very much a la London, you know, London fog sort of feel to it. What inspires you when you're writing and when you're creating? Do you have certain scenes, colors, senses, emotions that you're really feeling and putting onto the page of your book? Or is this something that just sort of evolves naturally for you?
Yeah, I mean, color is kind of a big deal. I knew for each book what color I wanted the cover to be. I was very specific that with my first book, Unblemished, that it needed to be purple, and this was why. With Wonderland, I knew it needed to be blue because Alice, that's blue. Alice is blue to me. With The Looking Glass Illusion, I've talked about this a little bit online. I hate the color red. I hate it. I'm sorry. I know that that's like your main color here at Poison Pen, is that's your logo, is there's red. There's red everywhere, but I've always hated the color red. To me, it says like danger, and but with The Looking Glass Illusion, it brought out a lot more, because the Queen of Hearts is red, and so Alice kind of discovering that red isn't so bad, but what does red look like for her, was very much in my mind as I was writing it, because Alice kind of comes away from that timid blue into more of a passionate, fiery red as she evolves through the story. So color is very much, I think, inspirational and important to me. Did you have some say, Candace, in kind of what you wanted on your cover?
Not really. And I wouldn't say color is as important to me. I think maybe just being in Beijing when I wrote it, there was a lot of neon, a lot of color. But I think it was more just like the culture, the tech, the food, even the music. I think that was really more of the inspiration. And I had no idea what to expect from my cover. I was like, here's, you know, some cool scenes. Here's what the book is about, but do what you want. So I didn't really have much of a say on that front.
It's a fascinating kind of feeling towards it. And I really appreciated, especially Sarah, your sense of creating kind of this feeling and change with Alice. As A, first of all, what inspired you to write with Alice and Alice Through the Looking Glass kind of idea? And then going and moving into the Looking Glass Illusion, did you always have a feeling and an idea of how Alice was going to evolve as a character? Or did she surprise you?
Alice definitely surprised me. I say that each book is like me learning something about myself, because each season that you write a book is just totally different. For Alice, I knew I wanted to write Alice because I love Alice. I played Alice at Walt Disney World in my college years. And so when I pitched it, it was kind of a different book when I pitched it to my publisher, because I'm a discovery writer. And so my stories evolve. I have an idea of where I want them to go, but I don't really know deep down, like, what is it with this character? And with Alice, it's that she's afraid. She's afraid of being abandoned. She's kind of afraid to kind of step out into her own thing, because she's always just kind of been overprotected by her older sister. And so I think as she evolves and as she kind of breaks out of her shell with Chess Shire by her side, I always like to say that Chess is my husband and I am Alice. And so he very much brings her out of her shell. She takes herself very seriously, and he lets her know that life does not have to be so serious. And so it wasn't something I intentionally inserted. I wasn't like, I'm going to write a book about me and my husband. It just kind of happened because I'm a discovery writer. I don't know about you, Candace, if you outline or...
Yeah, I do. I can totally relate though, what you're saying about the different seasons in life. You kind of write yourself in a way. I mean, this is my debut novel, but I have written other stuff. And this one was very much, the main character Urban was very much experiencing what I was, because I always kind of wondered, do I fit in China? Do I fit in America? Like, I have this really strange upbringing and I speak fluent Mandarin and I love Chinese culture, but I also love America. And so going back to Beijing as an adult was very much me figuring out, do I want to live here? Do I want to live as like a Chinese kind of, or do I want to go back to the US and live as an American? I'll never be a fully normal American, but I can try. And Urban is very much experiencing something similar, where it's in her world, everyone's divided by those who have genetic enhancements and those who don't. And she's sort of in this weird boat where she was born naturally, but she lives with the genetically enhanced and has to hide it. And so she also is kind of fluctuating between these two cultures and these two people groups. And it was a very similar thing. It was like, that was exactly what I was going through at the same time. So I think the characters definitely can, I can resonate with them at different points in times.
Urban is really an interesting character, and she does feel almost like she's definitely the fish out of water in this and trying to discover her place. Alice is as well. And I think that's something that a lot of teenagers deal with, is trying to figure out who they are, what they are. I think a lot of adults, though, we're all still trying to figure out, what are we going to do when we grow up? And though we pretend we may have the answers, we really don't. And sometimes it takes looking through a younger pair of eyes to solve those issues. What's it like going through, and how did Urban and Alice sort of surprise you, and how they handled their solutions?
I think for Alice, what surprised me with Looking Glass was that she and Chess kind of switched places a little bit. Not to give spoilers, but Alice kind of becomes a lot more confident and Chess becomes more insecure about some things, because he's facing some fears that he's been kind of like putting off facing for a long time, whereas Alice is kind of becoming much more determined and comfortable in her own skin. But I think you're right, and that's why young adult books don't really have an age group. I mean, they're young adult because they feature young adults, but I think that they're for any age, because at my age, I still am like trying to figure it out. I'm still insecure about things. I'm still unsure and figuring out where I am in my friendships and in my life. And so I think that seeing that through a teenager's eyes, I mean, we're really all teenagers at heart. So, I mean, we act like we're grown up. We may have more wrinkles, but in the end, like, I still sometimes feel like that 15-year-old girl, totally unsure, wondering who I'm going to sit with at the lunch table. And I think we can all relate to that. So that, I think, the most surprising thing for Alice was definitely that she kind of came into her own and maybe inspired me to be a little bit more confident in real life, too.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I've had so many people tell me I relate so much to Urban, whether they're teens or adults, because I think the thing is, as a teenager, we're expected to be finding ourselves and figuring out who we want to be. But then as adults, I mean, you take on new phases in life. So, for instance, I still feel like a new mom. I have a toddler, but I still feel like a new mom. And also being a debut author, you know, being an author for the first time. And so figuring out how do I navigate being an author and a new mom? And then, you know, we're moving. And so I think there's seasons as adults too, where you're navigating these new aspects of your life of what does it look like to be an author or a mom or in this new place. And so I think that's one of the things I love about young adult, what you hit on, is just these themes of belonging and finding yourself are still true as adults in different seasons. For Urban specifically, I think the thing that was fun and surprising was in this culture, everyone has like this social score, which dictates your standing in society. The higher it is, the better, the more popular, that sort of thing. And so she spends most of the book just trying to get this really high soch because she can achieve her dreams that way. But then she realizes like, that's not, I don't need, you know, a high social score. I don't need people's acceptance of me for me to accept me. And it's funny because like a year after I wrote it, I was like, oh, I need this reminder. It's so easy to be like, oh, I just really want to fit into Chinese culture or American culture. And I need, it's not a social score, but I need people to, you know, accept me as American or Chinese. And it's like, no, like I can accept myself. And so I think it's surprising sometimes how much what the characters are learning, is exactly what we need to hear.
Isn't it true though, that, I mean, oftentimes we think about, oh, that person went to Harvard, they must be really smart, you know, or, oh, they went to the right college, so they're going to get the big jobs and they're going to go to the right places and the right spaces. And really, what are the right places and the right spaces? You know, and is it really, you know, healthy? Is it good for the person themselves? Is it where they should be? And so it's always neat to see and explore that through young adult novels. And I think we often forget that as adults sometimes, you know, kind of that striving to succeed or getting to that place, that special social standing. And really, it's all high school when you boil it down. actually, you know, one of the cool things, though, is that Sarah's Looking Glass Wars, you are our top selling young adult novelist here in the store. We just went through gobs and gobs of the Looking Glass Wars. And there's really something really appealing about retelling fairy tales, and especially Alice. What is it about Alice, do you think, that is so captivating and captivates readers? And what captivated you about the original Alice? And what did you discover about Alice that even Lewis Carroll didn't know?
Oh, well, I can't claim to know more about Alice than Lewis Carroll. With the Looking Glass Illusion, because I love Alice, I really wanted to explore what my Wonderland looked like, because a lot of retellings, like the Looking Glass Wars by Frank Bedore.
First book wrong.
That's a, I am honored because I love the Looking Glass Wars. It's a great book.
This is why you always double check the titles.
The first book is The Wonderland Trials.
Wonderland Trials. Yes. Oh my gosh. Sorry about that. My fault.
No, I'm honored. I loved The Looking Glass Wars. I just want to make sure Frank's not online.
I'm just combining your books.
I knew what you meant.
I knew what you meant, but please correct me.
I knew what you meant. So with the Looking Glass Illusion, I've now forgotten your question.
Oh, so I think I asked.
I'm getting very old.
Yeah. About discovering Alice. Yes. What did you discover about Alice as you went through?
So a lot of the retellings that I came across for Alice in Wonderland were very dark and focused on that kind of like mental health thing. Well, I've already written a book about mental health. It's called Coral. It's a standalone retelling of the original Little Mermaid. And so for Alice, kind of coming off having written something about mental health, I wanted to write something that was fun. I wanted to write something that was fun to write and fun to read. And so with the Wonderland Trials and the Looking Glass Illusion, I knew I wanted it to be about games. Games in Alice in Wonderland, if you've ever read the original, are all over the place. There's card games, there's croquet, there's chess. And I just thought, why has nobody like written a book about like games? And I love the games trope. I love the Hunger Games. I love Ready Player One. I love Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, Warcross by Marie Lou, anything to do with games, I absolutely love. And so with Alice, I really just kind of wanted to discover that coming of age story that Lewis Carroll has, because here you have in Lewis Carroll's version, Alice complaining to her older sister that she wants pictures in books, and why can't more books have pictures? And in my world, you know, the flowers would talk to me. And then she goes to that world and she's like, this is nonsense. This is ridiculous, even though she's getting exactly what she asked for. And so she becomes the adult in the world that she's discovering, and the whole time all she wants to do is go home. And so it's like, you think the grass is greener, but it's really not. And so as Alice kind of goes into this world of Wonderland, and she's searching for the missing players, and she's realizing just that Wonderland isn't all everything that she thought it would be. And the people there aren't everything that she thought they would be. And so she's kind of having to discover truth. She's having to learn who she'll trust. And like we were talking about earlier, like for me, that was a huge thing, because I was kind of going through some trust issues as I was writing it. And so just kind of as Alice discovered truth and learning to trust others, I was doing the same thing in my real life. And so I think for me, what I discovered most about Alice is that I'm a lot like her, but also kind of want to be her when I grow up.
How about you with Under? What was it like discovering and building Under as a character? And what is it about her that you really admire?
I wish I could say games. I love, that was just to interject really quick, I loved all the games you had in your book. It brought me back to my teenage years. I played so many games and it was so fun. Not games though, unfortunately. We don't really have that with Urban. I think with her, for me, I love martial arts. I grew up playing all the sports until I tore my ACL 4 times. And so I tend to write those sort of characters that are hard charging. They love the martial arts. They, you know, love battles and all this stuff. And so I think this was the first book I wanted to write a character that was a little bit different, that wasn't going to be the natural loving all these things. And so I wanted to show a character who is still very strong, but maybe not in the physical sense. She wasn't enhanced. She's forced to do martial arts, but she's very reluctant about it. She doesn't want to do it. But so I wanted to show her and just how she had a strength all of her own, even though she wasn't enhanced. And even though physically she has asthma, she has all these issues because she's born naturally. So I just kind of wanted to play around with the idea of like strength and where does strength come from? Because I think we see in a lot of YA novels that the classic strength is just a physically strong protagonist. So I just kind of wanted to play around with that.
It's always sort of fun too, when you get the regular person who's dealing with and being able to put themselves on par with the genetically, we'll say genetically enhanced. Yeah. I think that's one of the things that's always, you know, been fun about, for instance, Marvel Comics, the X-Men or the Avengers, which Avenger or which X-Men do you, or actually which Avenger especially do you prefer? Do you prefer the one who's smart, who's created their own enhancement or their special suit? Or do you prefer the one who, you know, is like Thor, you know, he comes from, you know, being enhanced. And oftentimes you're rooting for the ones that had to be smarter, a little bit stronger. And Under is really interesting because she really has to deal with some real peril without having super abilities. And everything becomes a lot more real for her than maybe some of the other people that she's around. And I found, can you talk about what that was like putting her in that sort of situation, and how far do you want to take her peril, I guess?
as far as I can go. I mean, it's much harder, right? Because she can't just fight her way out. So there are definitely a lot of scenes where it's like, uh-oh, okay, she's in this, you know, she's in great peril. How am I going to get her out? She's going to have to think her way out, which I'm totally, let's just fight my way out of this situation. So it was definitely harder to write for sure. But I think it was a good stretching goal for me.
You know, you write action scenes very, very clearly. And another friend of mine, Tori Eldridge, who writes the Lily Wong series, she also is a martial artist. And so there's something about being, I think, really understanding the craft where you can really and then end up writing very clear action scenes. Because, you know, you can't describe a kata. You can't describe Krav Maga very easily. How is it that you approach the fighting scene? Because for her, she approached it more like a dance and where she would place and kind of put her characters onto the screen. So how about you? What do you do to do that?
Well, I started off doing martial arts actually because I couldn't write fight scenes. Anytime I had to have any sort of training or fight scene, I would just have such big writer's block because I didn't know anything about it. And so that's how I started doing martial arts was I was finally like, I have to finish this book, a different novel totally. And so I enrolled in Krav Maga and just totally fell in love with it and kept doing it. And but yeah, it's helped me with my writing. For one thing, I'll take little notes because I think it's a lot of times just the little details that you can easily get wrong, but that also can just make it so much more realistic. But then I think also just when you're doing martial arts, you get a feel for what works and what doesn't. Like a lot of if people are watching Marvel movies, for example, a fight on screen is actually very different than a real life fight. Like I actually took a stunt double class one time for screen, and I was amazed at how different it was than an actual fight. Like it's totally impractical. Like you in real life fighting martial arts, if you're going to punch someone, you would never telegraph it. Telegraph being like showing them that it's coming, because then your opponent can block it, right? But in like for film, you would always telegraph it so that the screen can see, oh, this punch is coming. And so it's very, very different. And so I think a lot of people see Marvel movies and they think, oh, you know, these spinning back kick and, you know, this flying Superman punch. And those are just so impractical. If you've ever done like any sort of sparring, you very quickly realize, you know, you have to keep your hands up. You don't waste any energy. And so I think just even sparring a little bit makes you realize like, oh, there's a lot of things that don't work. And you can't just randomly like throw your fist. Like you have to target specific points of the body depending on what you're trying to do. And so, yeah, I think martial arts, everything from the little details to helping me realize what I see on film, I can't really replicate that, to then just even thinking about my own sparring, like what worked, what landed me on the mat, what really hurt me, what worked well. I think just all that experience kind of pours into the writing.
Absolutely. And it's, you really do. I mean, this enhanced is kind of one exciting scene after the next. You really keep the reader very engaged. And the Looking Glass Illusion is the same, where you're really ratcheting up the tension and things are getting really real for Alice as well. How do you approach tension and action? Because your books usually aren't about yours. Your books are more about self-discovery in a lot of ways, like Coral, than with high action, but you still get in quite a bit of action within your books. What's your approach, Sarah?
I just always think anytime I'm going to end a chapter, what would people not expect here that would also fit the story? So I hate shock factor for shock factor's sake. I hate when TV shows kill off my favorite character because they've decided to go act on a different TV show. I think it's absolutely ridiculous. But if I can shock the reader, because I'm unfortunately very unsurprised. When I watch a movie or a TV show, I'm always the first in my family to say, that's the bad guy. And my family hates it, but but I have to let them know that I was right. And so I have to say it out loud. So for that, I like to try and surprise readers if I can, but also to put my characters in the worst situation possible. I always say give your characters really hard choices and put them in situations that are impossible to get out of. And so that's kind of how I approach it. Like, what's the worst possible thing I could do to my character right now without killing them that's going to propel them into forcing them to grow? Because nobody wants to grow. Nobody wants to change. You have to force your characters to grow where they have no other option but to go forward. And so that's kind of how I think about it. What can I do here that's going to give my character no other option but to go forward rather than going back to the old way of things? And for Alice, she really doesn't have a choice. She can't go back to the way things were once she's seen Wonderland. She can't unsee it. And so for her, she has to either move forward and keep trying to win the final trial in the Looking Glass Illusion, or she would have to go back knowing that she abandoned everyone, abandoned her team, abandoned the family that she's found for herself.
Those are high stakes. Those are really high stakes. Now that you've ended the series, what was it like to write that final page, to say goodbye to Alice? And kind of the same question for you, Candace, but the opposite. What was it like saying hello to Urban?
So with Alice, I've done everything. I've done a trilogy, and then I thought coming off a trilogy that a standalone would be so much easier, and it wasn't. And so I thought, well, a duology will be the sweet spot, two books. But I had no idea exactly how I was supposed to end it. This character, the Ivory King, is introduced in book one. I didn't know who or what the Ivory King was. I just knew that my characters would be looking for him. And so with the Looking Glass Illusion, I did not know how to end it, and it felt completely corny to me, but I still had to turn it into my publisher because I was way past my deadline. And I remember turning it into him, and then of course after I turned my edits into him, I said, oh no, I'm going to change the ending. So I didn't ask. I just went in and changed the ending and then turned it into him again, and I was like, never mind, this is the ending. And of course, because of that and waiting to turn it in, my release date got pushed back, which is just the nature of the publishing world. And coming off of 2020 with shipping issues taking longer, we had to push the date back. But it was what needed to be done. And I was really pleased with this one. Every book's a little bit different. I think the process for every book's a little bit different. I wrote the epilogue before I wrote the ending. And so I knew where I wanted my characters to be a year from now. And so I remember getting to probably about 75% through writing that first draft, and just, I didn't know what to do, but I knew what the epilogue looked like. And so I wrote the epilogue, and I wrote backwards from that. And it's the first time I ever did that. And I was really ended up being so stressed about it. I thought, this is the worst ending ever. But then as you step away and you step away and you give yourself room and breathing space from it, and then I've gotten good feedback from it, I realized that it's actually the ending it was supposed to be. And I was a little sad to say bye to Alice, but I'm also ready to move on.
I'm like soaking up this knowledge as I'm finishing this trilogy. I'm like, how do you finish and say goodbye? I mean, obviously with starting it, it's so much fun. You get to build this world and meet this character. And then, so book two is already turned into my publisher, pretty much done. And then I'm currently writing book three. So I feel like I'm already starting to feel withdrawals of, oh no, this series is coming to an end, because it's just been so much fun to write. Like, I love the world. I love the characters. That's why I wanted it to be a trilogy, because I'm like, I want to spend more time in this. I mean, standalones are so hard for me because I love the world building. And so I'm like, I don't want to go to all this effort, build this really fun world that I want to play in, and then it's just one book. So I'm glad it's a trilogy, but as I'm writing book three, I'm kind of already like, oh no, what am I going to do when this world is done? I love it. So I'm listening to you. If I extend my deadline to my publisher, I'll tell them I got the advice from you.
Thanks.
You've been around a while though, writing, Sarah, and you know when you need to push back a little bit with due dates. I mean, as much as publishers love us or love you guys to write a book a year, it isn't always possible. You've got life, you've got family, and you've got challenges sometimes with getting the plot. What was the Ivory King your biggest challenge within this book year?
Yeah, absolutely. The Ivory King, I remember asking one of my friends, she was like, oh, I'm so excited to learn who the Ivory King is. And I was like, well, who do you think he is? What do you think happens? I was like, she's like, wait, you don't know? And I even told my editor, I said, she was so excited for book two. And I said, I don't know who this is. And she goes, really? And I said, nope. So I'm going to figure it out. And it was definitely a challenge. That's kind of the curse of being a discovery writer, is I always figure it out at the last minute. I know I do. I know it comes, it's there, it happens, but it's really frustrating because I would really like to know the answer now, because I don't like surprises. And so, I would just say, if anybody's out there who's discovering their story and you feel totally lost, just keep writing. It'll eventually come to you. Usually the story, I say, finds me. So I didn't find the Ivory King. The Ivory King found me.
I've had a lot of friends who write, and they also will put it down for about a week or 2 weeks when they're done, and then not look at their book, and then go back and make all of the edits and reread kind of with a fresh pair of eyes, just so that they can figure out all their where they need to tighten things up. One of the nice things about traditional publishing is it takes a village to kind of create a book. And how do you feel working with editors, professional editors, to make a book better? And Sarah, you're also a professional editor yourself, right? So what's your advice to those people who are working and writing and trying to get their novel up to scratch?
Yeah, I would say, like, both indie publishing and traditional publishing takes a village, because you just have to choose your hard. Like, either I say, like, traditional publishing is hard, indie publishing is hard. You just have to choose your hard and which end of the rope you want to be on. And so whether you're indie publishing or traditional publishing, I would say, like, I think kind of the idea is that if you get into traditional publishing, that your publisher is going to do everything for you, and they're going to market it for you. And I do have a really, really great team. From the editing standpoint, I would say it's definitely hard when I have, you know, an author go past the deadline I'm expecting a book and it doesn't come across my desk. But I also know from the author standpoint how grateful I am for those deadline extensions. And I've learned as an editor to make time and wiggle room. And I've learned too, like, my publisher, and he probably would not appreciate me saying this to other authors, but they plan for that wiggle room. So when they give me a deadline, the deadline is really 4 months later. And because they plan, they know authors ask for extensions. And so as an editor, I try to have grace for that and know that, your deadline's here, but, you know, there's a little bit of wiggle room. And so it's definitely kind of having to push and pull and work together with your editor. Everybody needs an editor, whether you're traditionally published, indie published. Like, you have to go through all the stages of editing. Don't skip anything. It's really important. My books would not be as polished as they are without my team. Like, I absolutely know that there's nothing that I can do on my own. I have to depend on others to do it. I wouldn't have great covers if not for my cover designer. Anybody who's out there trying to decide which path, indie or traditional, I would say you just have to choose your hard, but know that you're going to have people that you rely on every step of the way.
I know Barbara's changed some sentences or reworded a couple things that I've written. I'm like, I sound brilliant. And it was really a broken half sentence that she just turned into magic. And that's part of the fun of a good editor, is that, you know, if you're meaning to say something and it isn't quite clear, they're there to work with you to kind of clarify it, get it clarified. Mm-hmm. Candace, was that a hard thing to learn from your first book, or did you kind of take it like a duck with water?
I think the editing process was fine. I think what's harder for me, it's not actually going through the editing process with my publisher that's hard so much as my own editing. Like, I mean, I mentioned I love the world building. I love the first draft. And then kind of like some of your friends, I'll sprint, I'll get the first draft done, and then I'll set it aside for actually 6 months. And then I'll come back to it and I'll start editing it and fleshing it out. But I hate editing. And so editing is my least favorite part for sure. And then by the time I turn it into my publisher, I feel like those rounds of edits, or even edits for my critique partners, I feel like those are fun because it's very clear. It's like, hey, this sentence doesn't make sense. Or, hey, there's this plot hole you forgot about. Or let's sharpen this language up. Versus me, when I'm editing my own novel, there's no clear roadmap. And it's like, okay, this part is broken, but I don't know why. And I have to figure it out. So kudos to you. I hate editing. I love it when I get editing feedback because then it's clear what I need to do. But when it's my own editing, I hate that part.
We're total opposites. I do not like writing. Great. I like editing.
I'll just write the first draft. We can co-write a book. You can edit all of it. It'll be great.
Sounds good.
You know, it's funny because we do have those writers like Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child, or the three W's, Willig, White, and Williams. Beatrice Williams, Karen White, and Lauren Willig. And it's fascinating because you get two writers together who are three writers writing together, and they turn it into one voice because of how, you know, how much editing and everything goes through. It's sort of amazing. You know, you have three writers, one voice, and it works really well, you know, and a lot of people do enjoy that. It's becoming more and more common kind of to have kind of, books that are co-written together, which is sort of fun. Sarah, what's next for you in terms of, so you're done with the Looking Glass Illusions and you've got something in the works, but we won't see it for a little while.
Yes. I wanted a break. I needed a break. And that's one of what you're talking about, pushing back with your publisher. I said, I cannot release a book next year. I just can't. I need to take a break from launch seasons, and marketing. And so they were very gracious and still gave me a 4-book contract. So I do have another 4-book contract with Enclave Publishing. It is it's going to be my first full fantasy series. My books usually have some of the real world in them, portal fantasy or what have you. And so this will be completely set in a completely other world. No portals yet. We'll find out. I always have to put a portal in there, but no portals to the real world. And so that will be a 4-book series all set in the same world, but they'll be kind of companion novels similar to Shannon Hale's Books of Bayern, if anybody's read those. And yeah. So each story will follow a different main character, and each of them is a mashup inspired by a story from classic literature and one of my favorite fairy tales. So I can't say more than that or I would get in trouble. But the first book in that series, which I'm very, very excited about because it's two of my all-time favorite stories, releases in July of 2025.
That's really cool. And Candace, you're writing two more books, are working on your third. And after that, do you know?
I don't. That is the question. Right now, it's just heads down, get book three done. And then, I don't know, I have a plethora of ideas, but we'll see.
That's really awesome, though, that your publisher really liked Enhanced to sell or get you to write two more. What's it like working with a smaller press? Enclave is known for publishing some really high quality books, but like the Poison Pen Press, not real big. You're working with a smaller group and a smaller team. Do you feel like that's a good fit for both of you?
I think it's my happy medium. Having written for a larger publishing house was definitely an experience I'm really grateful for, and they really opened a lot of doors for me. But I really love Enclave because I am friends with every single person on our team. all of our authors feel like family. We all support each other. And I feel so comfortable there. It feels like coming home. I'm very close with even our marketing director. My publisher also happens to be my literary agent. And so it's a very tight-knit group. I feel like they really care about their authors. I feel like I have a lot of say even in what I want for cover design and cover concept. And they don't always say yes to me, but I feel like they really have gone above and beyond to provide me with every tool that I need and every marketing support that I need. And just really those close friendships. So I'm happy where I'm at. I don't have aspirations at this point to go anywhere else.
Yeah, I think it's interesting as a debut author. I know a lot of other debut authors, and so just kind of seeing their experience with their publishers, and I've heard a lot of horror stories, but I really can't complain with Enclave. Like, they've been really good at communicating with me, and I think that is one of the big pluses with mm-hmm. being with the smaller press is just they always communicate with me, and I have a marketing background, and so I'm one of those weird authors who loves doing the marketing side of things. So it means I also have a lot of marketing questions because I want to know what we're doing, what our plan is, how I can help. And I think most publishers just wouldn't put up with that, and they'd be like, sorry, like, you're gonna have to wait with everyone else to find out what's happening. And I'm like, no, I have a full like 9-month plan and I need to know like what we're doing. So they've just been really great. And I think especially as a debut author, there's just, even though I understand marketing, there's so many book marketing, debut marketing things I just didn't know. And they really took the time to sit down with me and say, okay, here, you should probably think about this, or, you know, that's maybe not a great idea. Maybe we can pivot. So they've just been really great in sitting down and answering so many of my marketing questions. They're awesome.
I always think that it's probably the best medium, just seeing what, you know, what authors went through over the Poison Pen Press in just terms of being in a smaller, you got a lot more me time, which is sort of nice. And on top of that, though, the marketing budget isn't always as big, you really get to know your editors. You really get to know the people on staff because it's not very big, and they get to know the books better. And it's nice too, because then you don't get lost in the marketing shuffle. You know, some of these, I know some great debut novelists who didn't get past book two because, unfortunately, you know, Louise Penny came out with a big book and they put all the marketing money towards hers, which makes sense. She helps put the, you know, she helps pay the bills. But then other people end up getting lost in that shuffle. And Enclave, it's nice because there's enough of you, but not so many of you, that you don't get lost.
Yeah. With Enclave too, they really are good about promoting their backlist. And I've noticed a lot of publishers are focused mostly on those new books, but Enclave still promotes books that came out 10 years ago. And I'm really appreciative of that consistency, because I know in a few years, the Wonderland Trials is going to be old news, but I know that they're still going to post about it and promote it. Our marketing director has, I assume, an entire list of all these like ridiculous special days. She's like texting me, you know, it's Mad Hatter Day this week. And I'm like, how do you know this? But she pays attention to that, and she's very intentional about posting about those kinds of things. And so I'm appreciative about that with Enclave, because they answer all of our questions, and they're very intentional about letting us know what's working this year, what was trending last year, that maybe don't spend money on that in your marketing budget this year. I've been lost in that marketing shuffle for a book two with my previous publisher, and I did not feel that way at all. It's definitely different for a book two. You're not going to have the same amount of promotion, and it's not going to be that as big a deal as promoting book one. But I still felt very supported this second time around.
Your publishing usually goes into an S curve. It's like book one does really, really well. Book two, your second book, meh. Book three, meh. And then if you get to book four, book five, book six, book seven, it just begins to build and build and build. So you're usually, it takes a few years to get to the height that your first book was. But if you manage to stay the course, then you're getting more readership. And so that's the challenge, is getting past book two, right? But the exciting thing is that you're with a publisher that really believes in you. With this group, do we have any questions for Sarah or Candace on anything? Jake, do we have anything online? Oh, yes. Go for it.
So since we're here in Old Town Scottsdale and there's all sorts of delicious places to eat, I'm wondering if your characters got plunked into our world. I mean, Al is kind of already, where would you take them to eat? Or somewhere in China, like where would you go to like hang out with them for the afternoon and eat something delicious?
I don't know about this area because I'm not from here. I have no idea where to eat. But if I was in Austin, which is where I'm from, I would definitely take them to Lin's Asian bar. That has the best. We talked about Shanghai soup dumplings earlier. The best. And if I was in Beijing, I forget what it was called, but there was a place right next to my house that just had the best Beijing duck. Oh, I would take them there.
I feel like Chess is so adventurous. He would probably take Alice to some like random place that she's never been before with spicy food that she won't eat because that's what my husband likes to do. I think Alice, I mean, she's so much, she probably would just be happy going to Panera and getting the same thing she always eats all the time. Like a sandwich or something, or like a tea room, the English Rose tea room in Cave Creek. I would probably take Alice there. Chess, I feel like he's so adventurous, he would eat anywhere. But probably like Babbo Italian Eatery or something like that, I think he would really enjoy. I think he would enjoy eating, because he's, you know, in England. I think he would enjoy eating something that he's not used to. So Chinese, Thai, something really adventurous. He would probably like let you put a plate in front of him, like blindfolded, and he would just eat it. So really you can't go wrong taking Chess pretty much anywhere.
I could see that. Now, what's the most adventurous place your husband's taken you to eat?
That's a really good question. He introduced me to Thai food. I had never had Thai food. I know. Before I met my husband, I learned really quickly that you have to give them your spicy level, and I tell them zero. Which is not actually a number you can say, but I tell them zero. He asks for a 6, which is not a thing because it goes up to 5. So he gets like extra. Probably one of the most adventurous places he like physically took me was this like little hole in the wall, like mom and pop cabin place up in Utah. And it was raining and it was muddy and my shoes were ruined, but he was so excited to go to this like little cabin, like in the woods, that's a restaurant. And so physically that's probably the most adventurous place as far as like actual food, probably sushi or Thai food, which I know sounds really boring probably to everyone here because that's like normal food. But
Candace, you're having lived in China, what's the most adventurous food you've tried?
Either swan intestines, pig brain soup, or blood clot soup. Yeah, not exactly the most appetizing stuff.
Is it real blood clots? What is it?
Yeah, they look kind of like jello. They're just like, yeah. I wouldn't have eaten it, except it's very rude in Chinese culture. Someone puts food on your plate to not eat it. So, yes, I've had those things out of forced necessity.
I would not fit in because I would have been rude.
Or you would be very different by the time you left China and you would be ordering level 6 spice. I don't know.
Maybe. We'll see.
Yes.
So for both of you, do you have characters in these current novels that are written about someone in your actual life? And if you could do a spin-off of one character in your novels, who would you choose to write about?
I think the spin-off question is easy. It would be Ash. He's just very sassy, very silly. I'm already thinking about just like a short story spinoff because everyone's like, we need more Ash. And so I'm like, that would be fun. Real life, I would say the closest character is actually Urban, the main character. She just reminds me a lot of one of my best friends and roommates who was just absolutely hilarious. And going back to the whole someone who's really strong, but not in the physical sense, she was very strong. And so I think I pulled a lot of inspiration from her. But I wouldn't say it's necessarily based off of her, but that's probably the closest one. No one else like resembles anyone, I would say.
I think my favorite thing in books is Easter eggs. I like to put people into my books specifically for people to read them and know that they're that person, or I hide their names in there. I think in book one, there's a character in passing that Alice comes across when she's at an event for card playing, and he's the bartender, Steve, and she says something in her head like, he's very intimidating at first, but he grows on you once you get to know him, and that is our publisher. So for obviously Alice unintentionally is very much like me. Chess is very much my husband. Maddie Hatter is very much inspired by my youngest daughter who loves games. And then in book two, The Looking Glass Illusion, there's a character, I'm not going to say who or what she does or who she is, but her name is Erin. And she is based on one of my closest friends in real life, Erin. And I put her in there because that, like, to me, like, when I think of that character, that is Erin. So I like to hide. It's like my way of telling people, like, I love you if your name or your personality ends up in one of my books.
Maddie Hatter is a very cool character, and I really like her. She's one of those characters in your first book that really sings on the page, and every scene with her is just sort of a delight. It was telling that you enjoyed writing her quite a bit.
Oh, thank you. I didn't answer your spinoff question. I know you're still wondering if I'm going to answer that. Spinoff, there is a little thing in the epilogue of The Looking Glass Illusion that I don't want to say what it is, but there's a thing. And so the Hatter brothers, I would write a spinoff about the Hatter brothers. I'm not going to say why, but in my mind, there is middle grade series potential based on the Hatter brothers. And so if you read it and you read the epilogue, you can tell me if you think I should do that.
As writers, do you always have an idea in your mind, in the back of your mind, that's like, this will be a good book. This will be a good book. Do you have like a book of books, potential books, potential ideas?
I think as authors, we always have like ideas. You know, I have all these contemporary novels in my head that I want to write, and I'm so far off from being able to write a contemporary novel that would involve going to a different publisher and just something totally separate and being under contract for four more books. I think there are stories that I've pitched to my agent that went off into the wind that I have not written or explored since then. The story I'm working on now was like my third try of pitching a particular fairy tale to my agent and my publisher and saying, I want to rewrite this fairy tale. I want to retell it. How about this one? How about this one? And he kept saying no. And so then I just stopped pitching him that one and pitched him something else. And then I snuck the fairy tale in there so that I could still write it. So I think the one that I'm working on now is probably one of those, like, I've waited to write it because I wanted to wait until I was ready enough to write it because it's one of my all time favorite stories.
That's so cool.
My question is, because you have, both of you have all these ideas going through your head for future books or whatever, I mean, how do you turn those, I mean, how do you carry on or shut those ideas off? And, I mean, or is it always constantly going through your mind, even at night? I could just imagine trying to go to sleep and yet you're thinking of all this coming up or what you want to do. How do you manage that?
I think I go through phases where sometimes I am staying up at night and thinking about all these ideas. But then I think you can also get out of a routine of writing and you're just doing daily life, and then those ideas just kind of go away. So I think for me, it like comes and goes. And I would also agree with what Sarah Ellis said earlier about we have a ton of ideas, but I think sometimes you have to step back and think about, is my publisher going to publish this? What publisher do I want to go with? What story makes the most sense? Am I ready to write this? Different stories require different strengths. And so knowing your own strengths and knowing, am I going to do a great job with this? Or is this going to play to my strengths or not? So I think there's a lot you have to think about when you're selecting what is the story I want to go with next. And yeah, for me, it comes and goes. Sometimes I'm thinking about all the time, sometimes not.
Yeah, I think I agree with all of that. And I've learned to become a note taker. I've learned if I do not write it down, it's out of my brain the next day. If I do not write down that bit of dialogue, as much as I discover write, I have an entire like notebook of all of my notes on my phone. And I make it into a checklist because I keep it as like, this is what I want to include in my book. I don't know where it goes, but I know that he says this at some point. And so I think learning to be a good note taker is really important as an author, because you have all these ideas, and sometimes an idea that comes to you is actually not for this book. It's for two books later. And so I keep all of my notes from everything, because sometimes I'll go back and stuff I didn't use. I don't delete anything I cut. I have a whole separate document for anything I cut out of my books that are usually 10 to 20,000 words long. Because I never want to delete anything, because who knows if I might use that later on.
Any other questions?
Have you written into a story book a character that you just couldn't stand and you want to do? I want to give an example. I've heard an author here several years ago who she went on a trip, came back, and her apartment was supposed to have been completely painted, all that and she couldn't have. She came back a little bit early and there's a painter sitting there in the middle of her living room, smoking and doing nothing, and hardly anything had even been started. And she had been gone to. So in her next book, the person that was killed off was the victim. What? Have you done anything like that?
Yeah, what's the joke as authors, like, be careful or I might put you in one of my books? Like, yes, I mean, definitely those experiences pour, like, just natural. I may not mean to put a villain. Definitely in Coral, there is a character, a sister character in there who is just not kind. I fully believe that anyone can be like redeemed. Sometimes redemption comes through death, and them sacrificing themselves for somebody else. But some characters choose not to be redeemed, and that's true in real life too. And so a character in Coral definitely, I feel like, was based on several encounters that I've had with just mean girls growing up, because we girls can be mean. We can. And then in the book that I'm working on now, there is a character that I absolutely hate, and I'm struggling to make the reader hate her, because in my brain I hate her, but on page she's not coming out the way I want her to, which is why I like editing, because I know I can edit her to be that hateable person. So I don't think there's any particular, like, that one person is now in my book, but I think just those multiple experiences from life of the painter or the customer service person being mean, or like they give us ideas for those experiences that we give our characters, because they're relatable. Because even if we're writing science fiction or fantasy, we want to ground it in something that our readers can relate to.
Yeah, I think I'm the same. It's more of just, there's not a specific person that ties to a specific person in my book. It's more just like that feeling of how that boss made me feel when they threw me under the bus, you know, or that certain person, and then just incorporating those emotions into the book. So yeah, probably the same.
There are some mean people out there, aren't there? But your books are shining light that there are also great people, and there's great adventures and great stories. other than your books, which are absolutely fantastic, and I recommend for those of you who get the chance to order a copy of The Looking Glass Illusion and Enhanced, signed by the authors while they still are. Actually, which is really cool, is that Sarah's local, so one of the nice things is she periodically comes down and signs and inscribes books. So for those of you who are thinking of a great holiday gift that you can't just get anywhere, you can always contact the store, and Sarah will drive on down about once a month. She's usually down in this area, and she'll be glad to inscribe your book, and we'll send it out to you. So that is something that you always can do. We do it with a number of authors here in town, and so that's your opportunity. But this is your only chance to get a signed copy of Enhanced, at least for this year. So if you get the chance to order, plus when you order through the bookstore or through Poison Pen, we're a Times reporting bookstore, so we actually report to the Times what we're selling, who's hot, who's not. And so that's sort of nice if, when we can get somebody unexpected onto that Times board. So Sarah, Candace, who are you reading right now that you are absolutely loving?
It's a tough question because as authors, we don't really have a lot of time to read anymore. I am reading Nadine Brandis's Out of Time series right now because I've been very in the mood for dystopian. I'm actually listening to it because that's really the only way I get a book done anymore. And then I'm very surprised that I am loving A Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes by Suzanne Collins. I wanted to, it's so good. I see you in the back. No, it is so good. I am so surprised. I put off reading it for a long time because I thought, who wants to read about President Snow? He is evil. He is awful. We know what happens to him. And I did not want to read it, but the movie comes out soon. And so I thought, you know what? I read all of the Hunger Games. I'm really just in the mood and I love it. So it's not my typical kind of book. I do not like that downward villain arc, but it's fantastic. And so if you love the Hunger Games, I do recommend Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes. At least I haven't finished it, so I may not recommend it, but I recommend it at 60% through.
All right, you're selling me on it. I wrote it off. I was like, I'm done. I don't know. I'm seeing some passionate head shakes and nods, so I don't know. We'll see. To 80%. Okay. Currently, I'm reading Catherine Briggs. I just finished her novel, The Eternity Gate, which just came out. And then because I'm her critique partner, I got to read book two, which is really exciting. And then also C.J. Malesi's Fugitive of Talionis, which is releasing soon. Yeah. And then I've just been grinding away at book three and have not been reading as much as I would like to.
You've got a lot of books to go through. Absolutely. Well, I've got to say both of your books are well worth the time, our time as readers, and I am so excited to be promoting and helping sell your books. So both of you, thank you for taking the time to writing your books. To our online audience, thank you for joining us, and to our local audience, thank you for joining us. There's still plenty of goodies out there for you to help yourself to, and Sarah and Candace will be glad to sign your books.
Thank you guys. Us. Thank you.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.